Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Patricia Taft, who is the director of the Transnational Threats Program at the Fund for Peace, which examines how weak and failing states can facilitate global nuclear trafficking by criminal and terrorist networks. She also leads a project which engages local civil society actors in West Africa in the creation of early warning systems to prevent mass atrocities and genocide in countries recovering from conflict. She previously served as a legal advisor to the government of Uganda on the Joseph Kony case before the International Criminal Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Patricia Taft.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the Fund for Peace's annual Fail State Index that's just come out ranks the world's 178 countries, ranging along the spectrum from exceptionally unstable nations such as Somalia and the Democratic Republic of Congo and the Sudan at one end, and then at the other end, the exceptionally stable countries of Scandinavia, etc. So I take it that Somalia was at the top of your list last year as well, was it?
Yes, it was. Unfortunately, it has been the chart topper, actually, for the past 6 years, I believe. And although there were improvements in Somalia from the previous year, it still is classified as the world's most fragile state.
And in terms of the next category down, which is what, the very high alert status?
Yes.
These are Chad, Yemen, Afghanistan, Haiti, Central African Republic, Zimbabwe, Iraq, Cote d'Ivoire, Pakistan, Guinea-Bissau, and Nigeria. So what's the difference then between the top category of Somalia and the Congo and the next down category that I just listed?
The main difference is what the index ranks is a state's or a country's susceptibility to violent outbreak. And it also looks at the actual institutions of a state, the capacity of a state, its institutions. And so I would say that the main difference between the countries like Somalia, Congo, Sudan, and South Sudan, which are in the very high alert categories, and the countries directly below it, which are in the high alert, has a lot to do with the actual functioning and capacity of the state, whereas a state like or a country like Somalia has virtually no capacity whatsoever. It doesn't control its territory. It cannot administer to the majority of its people. It does not have, for the most part, a legitimate or representative government. The countries below that are also extremely prone to conflict for various reasons, ethnic reasons, tribal divisions, et cetera, also in the case of Afghanistan, emerging from conflict, or Haiti, which is emerging, obviously, from a terrible earthquake. But they more or less do have some functioning governments, although it may not be considered legitimate by some or the majority of the people. It is much more functioning than the states that are in the top of the index.
And Patricia Taft, given that there's a civil war going on in Syria and the country is broken, embattled, and in effect being destroyed, and there's no end in sight, why is it ranked in 21st position? Only it's on alert status, which is what the third category down, is it?
Yes. I mean, unfortunately, with the index, what happens at the top or at the worst end of the index is actually akin to like a traffic jam. And so it takes, it can take a relatively short amount of time for a country to get into the high alert categories and take a very short amount, or a long amount of time, rather, to come out of that category. So it is a bit of a traffic jam. Syria has been worsening, obviously steadily over the past few years, but keep in mind the index actually measures, although it's the 2013 index, it does measure the previous year. So the most worsening in Syria, of course, has been happening over the past year and a half, but it has been measured in 2012. And so it is rising in the index, obviously, and that position is quite a bad one. If you look at who its neighbors are in that position, Burundi, Uganda, Liberia, North Korea, it certainly doesn't have great neighbors in that category. But the countries at the top of the list, we could say, have been fragile or failed for quite a long time.
So, in terms of your fail state index, again, the Fund for Peace have come out with an annual fail state index report. It's just been released for 2013. and it uses 12 indicators, and apparently the data is fed into a conflict assessment software tool known as CAST. So tell us about the 12 indicators.
The 12 indicators represent a broad look at basically social, military, economic, and political indicators. And within or underneath each of those indicator categories, there are specific sub-indicators which measure within that indicator category the state's susceptibility in that particular category. And as you noted, it is a software tool, and what it does is it actually primarily relies on reports from the media and scans millions of articles per year and groups them into the specific indicator categories and has a bit of a complex way of scoring and doing that sort of thing. But the indicators themselves are broad, but underneath those indicators, there are specific sub-indicators, again, to catch specific problems in a country.
So when you've got a situation like Syria where it's changing on a daily basis, how do you calculate, for example, the spillover effect? Because Syria, millions of people have left Syria, and the refugee crisis, my understanding, is impacting Jordan more than any other country, but it's also impacting Turkey and Iraq, and there's also a possibility that Iraq is a domino that could fall because the Sunni who have been marginalized in Iraq are very angry, and they're supporting the rebels in Syria. So presumably the war in Syria has emboldened them. So I'm just wondering how the cross-border aspects of this study operate.
Sure. I mean, it's huge. As you've noted, basically, we like to say here, you know, no state is an island, although some states are indeed islands. But as far as their effect on what's happening around them, particularly in what's happening in the Middle East and what's happening right now in North Africa, we do individual measures for each country, and certainly in the case of Jordan and Lebanon and Turkey, there we have individual indicators that measure things like refugees and things like pressures on population and pressures on food supply and that sort of thing. And they've all spiked in those countries over the past few years because of what's happening in Syria. And we've also seen in other cases what's happening in the Middle East very much now beginning to affect North Africa and West Africa, and seeing certain countries that don't get a lot of attention, like Burkina Faso and Guinea and these sorts of countries, really starting to take a nosedive in the index. And when we dig a little bit deeper into the data, it's kind of a direct result of arms trafficking and flows of people and so on that is being precipitated by the violence in the Middle East and in North Africa. So certainly they are all connected. And it's very easy to kind of trace the effects of what's happening in one state, the effects it has on another state, and also the region writ large.
So my understanding is that one of the metaphors that you're using in your study, the failed state index for 2013, and again, this is produced by the Fund for Peace, and you can get this study at fundforpeaceoneword.org. You use the Humpty Dumpty metaphor. I take it, and that's with the worst-case scenario, which is Somalia, the notion that all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty back together again, right? Is that that's how that metaphor works?
That is how that metaphor works. And, again, it's the concept that a country can kind of explode or implode, in the case of Somalia and many others on the index, very, very quickly. But the actual, as we've seen probably all over the world, the actual process of state building is very complex and requires, you know, immense amounts of money and time and resources and so on. And so in a case like Somalia, which has basically been a completely destroyed, you know, state for two decades, actually rebuilding state institutions and putting those pieces back together again is a very, very long-term process and, you know, obviously requires a huge amount of commitment from the international community and certain circumstances in certain cases. And certainly with Somalia, I would say for a long amount of time, the political will for that just has not been there.
Well, just to give our audience a sense that this is not entirely bleak, because we are talking about the really failed states, and in this case, the Humpty Dumpty phenomenon with Somalia, you do have a list of the most improved states. And at the top of the list is Japan. Is that to do with Japan's recovery from the Fukushima meltdowns? Is that a big factor there?
Yes. I mean, Japan is actually a good example of what happens with strong states that are able to recover, that have strong institutions. So even though it did have this sort of horrific sort of, triple disaster with the earthquake and the tsunami and the nuclear meltdown, it was able to recover relatively quickly and, still managed to function throughout that crisis, whereas you have a country like Haiti, which had that horrific earthquake in 2010 and still, for the most part, has not recovered from that. But there are other countries on the list that have improved that are, quite impressive. Indonesia is always one that gets a lot of attention for how it's improved over the years. And then other ones like Sierra Leone, that's shown quite a bit of improvement, and East Timor, and those cases that were pretty much international basket cases, a couple of years ago, and now are relatively stable.
Well, when you mentioned Indonesia is the most improved, Indonesia, of course, recently, huge chunks of Indonesia were on fire because apparently, landowners and outside speculators from China, et cetera, are burning off the rainforest in order to plant palm oil plantations. And the fires got so big. I saw satellite pictures. It's like half of the country was on fire. And this huge plume of smoke was drifting across Malaysia and Singapore. And people couldn't breathe in Singapore and Malaysia. So it's a bit odd that they are improved when just recently in the news it looked as if the country was not only destroying its own ecosystems to have palm oil plantations, but it was also affecting the health of its neighbors.
Sure. But the index, of course, measures what happened in 2012. So
I see.
What's happening in Indonesia will undoubtedly be captured next year, but in large part, and it will be captured in certain indicators, but in large part as far as issues of wide-scale human security and the vulnerability of civilian populations to wide-scale violence and harm and so on. Indonesia is certainly, while it's obviously not ideal and certainly not at the good end of the list, it certainly has improved and continued to improve over the years. So I think what you're speaking of will, certainly be reflected in next year's index.
So it's, in other words, the index does include environmental as well as human factors.
Absolutely.
So tell me then about the most, we just talked about the most improved, the most worsened, where you've got Mali at the top, Mauritania second, and Syria third. So has that changed much from 2012? I guess, Syria's gone up since 2012, right?
Syria has gone up. Mali, of course, continues to worsen. And the other countries that are sort of at the top with Mali, Mauritania and Burkina Faso, a lot of that, again, as I had mentioned earlier, has to do with the regional effects of the crisis in Mali. It's really spread to its neighbors, to Burkina Faso and Mauritania. And so that directly contributed to their worsening in the index this year. And countries like Senegal and so on had a bit of a political crisis in 2012. They've weathered it. They've come through, but there was a political crisis in that country. And then an interesting one, of course, is the world's newest country, South Sudan, which we gave a provisional ranking to last year because it was only a country in 2011 for half a year. But this year we had a full year worth of data, and unfortunately, it's not one of our best performers. Although it is a brand new country, and of course is emerging from decades of conflict.
And one of the biggest countries on the planet, and the one that has the highest growth rate, and some people suggest may become the global hegemon in the next few decades, is China. And it was number 3 on the worsening list last year, and it's now at, number 5. So what are the factors there in terms of – that's a bit of a paradox, isn't it? Everybody seems to think that China is going to own the world.
There are 12 indicators, and so economically, China in many ways is doing quite well. But there are other factors. I mean, when we dig into the data every year, when we look at China, we're constantly amazed at the things that we find about, you know, in one year there's something like 80,000 labor riots and protests, deadly labor riots and protests within China. That there are, again, huge, we're talking about environmental pressures in Indonesia. China is, you know, one of the most egregious actors as far as environmental degradation on the planet. And so that, of course, drives its score. And so beyond just its improvements economically and, some areas politically, taking all of the indicators into account and looking at it, China still tends to perform very poorly in certain areas. And obviously human rights is one where it continues to not show a lot of progress.
Well, I recall a few years ago, Patricia Taft, that the Pentagon did a study, I think it was during the Bush administration, on the most dangerous failed states in the planet. And they listed Pakistan and Mexico at the top. Maybe that was just in terms of the Pentagon's focus, because they're deeply involved in the war in Afghanistan. But I noticed in your study, that your failed state index that's just come out, that Mexico is at number 97. So how could the Pentagon just a couple of years ago say it has the greatest potential for becoming a failed state, and yet it's, you know, right in the pretty much in the middle of the chart?
Well, I think you hit it a bit on the head there by saying that obviously that study was looking at U.S. Specific U.S. strategic interests, and Mexico, when it was ranked that way, of course, was having, you know, horrific problems with drug wars and mass killings and so on, and that continues to go on. Although I believe when that study was commissioned, it was really at the peak of that violence. Pakistan again is is a threat to our interest in Afghanistan. It certainly, in many ways, is a global exporter of instability and terrorism, and so it certainly is not just for the United States, but also for other countries, a high concern. But again, because the index is often very much driven by events, and so it's event driven by the previous year. Although I don't have the index from that specific, you know, year in front of me, or the Pentagon study, my guess would be that there were probably a very high level of incidents captured in those two countries during that year, which worsened its score, whereas last year probably not the same number or the same intensity of incidents. So that would account for the difference.
So how, Patricia Taft, again, Director of Transnational Threats Program at the Funds for Peace, who have just released their annual Failed States Index report for 2013, when I read off the list of the second category, the very high alert status, that's Chad, Yemen, Afghanistan, Haiti, Central African Republic, Zimbabwe, Iraq, Cote d'Ivoire, Pakistan, Guinea, Guinea-Bissau, and Nigeria. When you look at these countries, you can't help feeling that so much of the problems are to do with its governance and particularly its leadership. We have nothing but problems with Karzai in Afghanistan. Haiti is ruled by a former singer who was elected with about 5 or 10% of the vote because the main party was forbidden from running. And then you've got Central African Republic, which is now in a state of chaos with coup and counter-coups going on. Zimbabwe, you've got the aging despot, Robert Mugabe, who just made a pronouncement that all gays and lesbians should be locked in a room and forced to procreate. So there's no shortage of terrible leaders in these countries, or incompetent leaders in the case of Jonathan Goodluck in Nigeria. So what's the is that a factor in your calculus, just the people at the top?
Absolutely. I mean, it gets to, again, this sense of we measure, and it's not directly reflected in the indicators, but we are taking into account when we're doing the index, what we call the core institutions of the state, which is, you know, leadership and the health of the leadership and the health of the military and the police and the judicial system and so on. And so certainly in all of his cases that you mentioned, the leadership in those countries is horrifically, in some cases corrupt. and deadly and you know many others. And so yes, it's absolutely taken into effect. And certainly in the indicators for those scores to be high and for things to spike in the indicator categories, you know, if you had competent leadership, you know, you would not have things like mass killing or endemic wide scale corruption and so on and so forth. So yes, I mean leadership and those issues are absolutely taken into account in the index.
Well, just in closing then, Patricia Taft, how do you expect your annual reports to be? I mean, who are your customers? And I mean, you know, is it so much of what one hears is sort of makes you just wring your hands in despair? And, you know, the UN is not exactly in a position to help a lot of these countries. A lot of these countries, of course, most of them, in fact, all of them are members of the UN at any rate. I'm just wondering in terms of who your audience is, what you're trying to achieve, and what the effects of your reports have been.
I mean, our audience is everyone from, you know, governments themselves to the NGO community to the UN to donor community, et cetera. Basically, anybody who has an interest in you know, the global health of countries. What we're trying to do mostly is draw attention to countries that are at such high risk. Again, the index really measures, it's called the Failed States Index, but what it's really measuring is the susceptibility of these countries to failure or collapse or violent conflict. And so what we're trying to do is draw attention to countries that are at high risk of violence or violent conflict and at high risk for, you know, incidents or cases like Syria where you have 100,000, you know, people that have died and huge humanitarian disasters and so on. And so hopefully bring attention to these countries in cases where we can do something before it becomes a complete disaster like a Somalia. And in cases like Somalia or in cases like Congo or Sudan, look at those areas where specifically aid can be applied and most effectively and can be used to help. And instead of someone just wringing their hands and saying, well, the whole country is a complete mess and so we can't do anything.
Well, Patricia Taft, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Patricia Taft, who's the director of the Transnational Threats Program at the Fund for Peace, which examines how weak and failing states can facilitate global nuclear trafficking by criminal and terrorist networks. She also leads a project which engages local civil society actors in West Africa in the creation of early warning systems to prevent mass atrocities and genocide in countries recovering from conflict. She previously served as a legal advisor to the government of Uganda on the Joseph Kony case before the International Criminal Court. And the Failed States Index report from the Fund for Peace is available at www.fundforpeace.org. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Claire Goldsmith and Nick Garino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.